One of the things I remember particularly is just the people who lived in the street, like, for example, Mrs. Swift, who lived on the opposite side of Colville Road and who often used to lean on her gatepost chatting to people. And we all knew that poor Mrs. Swift suffered from agoraphobia, and were very concerned as to, you know, what would happen to Mrs. Swift when the M11 eventually did come about. And next door, I think Sheila Thompson was her daughter, and Sheila was someone who was active in the Residents Association, again a long-term resident, I think a single parent, and had quite a few children. And I remember her sort of saying about, because this little gang of children that would go up and down the street playing, because very few traffic actually came round Colville Road, it was like a cul-de-sac, so the only cars that would come round there would be really people who lived there and were parking their cars. And so this little gang of kids would go up and down the street, and sometimes they would literally follow you in the house. Because I remember when I first moved in and Taro moved in downstairs, the kids were like really curious and asking lots of questions, and then they wanted to come inside and help us with the painting. And every so often we'd get a little knock on the door and they wanted to see how the painting and decorating was going. They were sort of really curious to begin with, and then they got used to you. But they did come in the house, and they did, like, we gave them a little brush and they started painting to make themselves feel like they were doing something, and chatting all the time, and that sort of thing. It wouldn't be allowed these days. And I do remember Sheila saying that one of the things that really concerned her was that, you know, when the motorway came, and if they got moved somewhere else in the borough, like, you know, she kind of says to her children, or said to her children, that they wouldn't be able to go in and out of people's houses in the same way. And she said in Colville Road, she knew that she could trust the people in the street because she kind of knew everyone in the street, and that the children would be treated by every other person in the street as she would a parent to a child. And that does seem quite unique. And in a way, it was like, I think probably similarly with Claremont Road, because there were those little cul-de-sacs, it was almost like this little pocket of a community that had sort of almost unchanged, remained unchanged for many years. And I also remember, there's lots of people from that street that I can remember in terms of what they looked like, but I didn't know them by name, although they would always say hello as you pass them in the street and have a quick chat or whatever. And I used to love the sound of the street in the morning and all the people going to work when I was working in my studio. And I used to like getting up early and being in the front of the house, having a coffee and thinking about some ideas for work or just working. And just all the footsteps. And it seemed like quite a lot of people would use Colville Road, because it was a back road that kind of leaped directly onto the station. So I think a lot of people would walk down Colville Road, and also it was a nice road to walk down because that meant you didn't have to walk alongside busy Grove Green Road, which was a chocker with traffic and lorries and so forth. And we did actually have one tragedy down there that I remember. A four-year-old boy was killed by traffic, and I don't know the circumstances of which it happened, but I know that all the long-term residents on Colville Road were talking about it and very upset. And so you'd walk down Colville Road, and I also enjoyed getting up early in the morning and going off to teach at Brighton or Loughton College, and I'd walk down Colville Road, and then at the end of the road, as it turned right, there were these steps, and they were like sort of, I don't know, like this 1940s concrete steps that had been left over from the war, with this metal rail, simple metal rail. And I'd go up that steps and then cross Langfourne Road, and then down these other little steps at the other side, which were surrounded by these bushes, into this kind of road called Station Road, which had a really kind of secret feel about it. Very sort of Mrs. Faversham. And it seemed to be like the street that everyone forgot. It was a street that was like a pocket where a lot of evictions had already carried out and people had left. So most of the street, probably about 50% of those houses, were empty and boarded up. And then some were lived in. And again, they seemed quite rambling big houses. And there were all these like overgrown back gardens. Because of course, the motorway was going straight through that street. And it was the street that time forgot. In the sense that with what happened later with the campaign and so forth, no one really knew about residents on Station Road. It was like a ghost street in a way, that it somehow never seemed to be part of any local residents campaign. It probably was, but you just didn't hear anything about it. And anyway, I'd walk past this particular house that had its door open, that had been derelict for years. And then one day I sneaked in there on my way to work, and in the front room there was this rosary in the middle, which had fallen down the wiring of the light in the centre of the room and broken like some Victorian parasol. And in the back room, the wallpaper had fallen off the wall and draped rather like my cotton sheet curtain in the studio. But it was the wallpaper, and it was right alongside this boarded up window. And to my absolute delight, there was rose wallpaper on the walls, because for me, I'd been working with rose wallpaper and as a sort of symbol of the kind of English rose, but as one, an image of kind of dereliction and dilapidation and decay and neglect and forget. And I decided to come back and take some pictures anyway, and I was in conversation with the photographer's gallery, who'd gone to see a show of mine at Cambridge Darkroom, where I'd had been working with Kay Roberts' Actualities, but as I said, her programme had to fold up. But I'd started working on a derelict house in Docklands, an old lock, and I'd made these 8-foot square photographs and traced in the archives, Limehouse archives, the former residence of these properties. And the photographer gallery had gone down there. It was David Chandler who'd gone to see the work. And he wrote to me inviting me to take part in a show called Invisible City. So I decided to do a piece in the house in Station Road. And I found an old postcard for a woman that I thought looked a bit like me. Again, a Victorian image, quite simply dressed. And I blew this up to life size and I sighted it on the wall in Station Road and photographed it in situ. So it looked as if this woman was standing there. You had a double take. Was she part of the wallpaper or was she standing there? And I also photographed the rosary, the parasol, but never ever exhibited that, just because I never found a context. And then, anyway, I blew up the image, the documentation image of the woman in that house, and onto canvas and stretcher like a painting, and printed a black and white image on colour paper so you got this soft tone. And I made it as part of a triptych of images, including a very large central image of a derelict backyard. Also another image found from archives. So I was mingling images from archive and images from that place in Station Road. Because it's almost like sometimes the archive is actually on the street, that idea. And I called the piece Homeless History, with reference to not just the M11, but at that time what was happening in London with the mass evictions of people, you know, down in Docklands, and the kind of level of redevelopment that was going on without consultation. And that whole thing about, I wasn't really involved in public inquiries or anything of that sort, though my boyfriend at the time, Howard Slater, was a writer, and he used to go down to all the public inquiries, but said they were all pointless really, because what would happen would be a load of local residents would get very upset because their voice was not being heard. And of course all the public inquiry was very tokenistic, so it just seemed so negative that all these decisions had already been made and nothing could be done. And there was a particularly long public inquiry over 21 days in June and July 1987. And Sheila Thompson and various local residents went down to that. But I think very much the attitude amongst a lot of the artists was that you couldn't really do much about it. It had already been decided. It had been decided years ago. And with all respect for the local people who, you know, had their houses were blighted, particularly the people who had bought them years ago, and just the sort of whole injustice of it all, and no consideration for the people that had spent their whole lives in those houses, and particularly people like Mrs. Swift, who was quite ill, and just how, you know, things like that can just go ahead, but it's the story of the world, really. And, you know, so particular to working class history, where people just don't have a voice. But other artists did get involved in the public inquiries, but because I left slightly earlier as well than some of the other artists there, I think I left in 1993 or 94, sort of in between, but I actually left a little bit before that, because I left around 1992, and I began to use 34 Colville Road as a studio, and I moved into another short life place in Hackney. Because around 92, you could really feel the area getting more and more run down, even though there were attempts by, you know, the artists and local residents to keep the place looking, you know, fairly good. And squatters started to move in, and the community was changing as people were moving out, and it started to feel less secure. And things were happening, like actually in about 2 years before 1990, I would say freeloaders. There are a lot of kind of freeloaders coming down to the area and just ripping off things. Like, for example, number 32 Colville Road next to me had been, you know, empty, and it wasn't inhabitable at all. And Acme, I think I said, tried to get that house, but they couldn't because it had been condemned, basically. And I think there had been a fire in the house, and the previous residents had left some years before. But it was a Sunday, and there were two men on the roof of that house, dressed in overalls, like they were council workers or something like that. Big, kind of burly men that you just didn't want to mess with. And I leaned out of my bedroom window and said, asked them what they were doing and where they were from. And they said they were from the council. And they stripped all the lead tiles off that roof. And I didn't know at the time, but as the months went by, I got some incredible damp on my studio wall. My house was perfect. It had no damp whatsoever. And then, because all these tiles had been taken, and some probably had been taken from the side of my roof as well, although I never did get the chance to look. And my ceiling started to leak very slowly. Like, you couldn't see the water, but this big damp patch appeared. And actually, I really loved that house and really looked after it. And it was sort of really depressing to see that someone could just come along and just do that. And my studio became wrecked. There was a big damp patch on the ceiling, and down the side of the wall became like this sponge, and the damp came in, and it became very difficult for me to use that part of the studio, which was about a quarter of the space. And so I decided to move as well, but it wasn't just that. my neighbour downstairs had moved out to Glasgow and was subletting to different guys, and I didn't really know who they were. They weren't artists, and it just didn't seem the same, and it didn't seem secure really. And the guys downstairs would never double lock the door, so it was totally on a latch. You could literally kick that latch through. And one day I came home to find, as I opened the door, the yell, not the yell, there was a chain on, so I couldn't get in. And I realised that the place was being robbed. So I ran into the house of the lady who had the children, the other side of 32, and explained what was happening. And her son and called me to run through the house, and we ran through her house into the back door, and he chased them over the fence, and the back window was open. So we climbed through Tara's back window and undid the chain on the door, and we couldn't, luckily they hadn't gone up into my flat and nothing was missing. But there was some audio equipment of Tara's which was stolen, and I just sort of started to feel a bit vulnerable about kind of issues like that really. So that's when I decided to just perhaps use the space as a studio and move all my valuables out really. But there were stories of other things going on. But I remember Pete Owen saying that he went away, and this may have been a little bit earlier than 1990, and he came back to his house and found the front door open. So he went in his house looking round to see if anything had been stolen. He found absolutely nothing was stolen, apart from, I think it was something on the electricity box that had been taken, a fuse or something. And that was kind of a mystery. So I don't know, just things like that, and just the general sort of, it seemed to change quite rapidly, and I just don't feel safe actually living here. And I think I was right actually, because when I started to read in the archives some of the events that began to take place down the street, and the actions of the Department of Transport and so forth. I mean, there was another incident where there was a guy called Richard who was a musician, and his girlfriend were actually living on Grove Green Road. And this was while I was still living there, actually. And they just went to work. And I think it was while I was still living there, or maybe when I was using it as a studio. They went to work and they came back, and all their stuff had been removed, and the Department of Transport were kind of evicting their house, and it actually had been a mistake. Some letter hadn't been sent or something. So just sort of stories like that really. And when I was moving out finally, Richard Latham knocked on my door and asked me if I could give him the key so they could arrange for some squatters to move in. And I said, look, Richard, you know, it's really difficult because there was somebody living downstairs, one of these guys who Tara was subletting to. And I said I couldn't really give the keys because of that. And also, I had to hand them back to Roger Kite at me. And, you know, if I didn't, then I would be, you know, in trouble with Roger. And I thought, not just that, but, you know, if in the future I wanted to have a studio and so forth, it could affect, you know, the agreement. And anyway, Richard was okay about it. And so, I'm sure the place was squatted later, because I did actually say to Richard, I mean, I said, the lock is so vulnerable anyway. I mean, it's just this yow. Just kick it and the door will open, you know, and it's no big deal. But I just had to stick to my part of the agreement with Acme, really, and respect that. So I suppose those were the people I knew down. There was also, like, at the station, there was really nice guy who worked there, who's since retired, who used to chat, you know, to the artists coming through the barrier and so forth. And in those days, you didn't have to have a ticket. You could pay at the other end. And because I'm not saying who that guy is, he used to just let us straight through. And I remember one time coming home quite late, and with a gang of people from Colville Road, and we all walked down the side of the tracks. I mean, God, one would never do that now. And jumped over our fence as a bit of a laugh into our back gardens to get home. But I do think it was quite a special time, really, because it was a good time for artists and people of my generation, because we were like, you know, most of us, a lot of us were in our late 20s, 30s, and quite a crucial time, and had the space. And also, I think there were more jobs around then as well, because I know that quite a lot of people as well got work at the Whitechapel doing talks and workshops, and I did as well. And I met Steve Nelson through the workshops there, and up and down the road. I mean, I didn't really know Steve, but because I'd done the workshops, I would recognise him and just say hello. And it was just this movement up and down those roads, and you'd see quite a lot of artists. And even if you didn't go into their house, you would often end up walking down the road with them because you recognised them from the Northcote and would just start chatting. And I often used to meet Rachel Garfield actually walking down Colville Road, because she lived in Claremont Road, and we'd often have a chat. And Sheila Whittaker, and I used to see Gary Doherty a lot, although he didn't live in the area. And in the Northcote pub, there would be big groups of artists, and you could join whatever group you liked, chat to different artists, and that was really nice. Although I'm not a kind of regular pub goer, but if I was a loose end, I would go down and just have a relaxing evening there. And quite often we would talk about ideas for work and stuff, so it was quite engaging. And a few more things about my little journey to the train station. So I'd quite frequently walk down Station Road because I really liked that street. But sometimes I would walk down, I'm not sure if it was Grove Green Road or the little road in between, which I think was called Trevelawan Road, I think, because at the end of that house there was this really interesting looking house with a dark green door. And quite often this really beautiful woman would come out, and I thought she was beautiful because of the clothes she wore. She just had this style that slightly, you know, sort of contemporary Victorian. And she would come out her door looking so happy with this other, like, really handsome guy. And I used to like to get a glimpse of what she was wearing to see if I could copy it, or maybe one day make a pattern for whatever she was wearing. So there were some interesting kind of local characters. But I do remember quite sadly walking, after years of walking down that street, and like, I suppose the idea that you just catch these little snippets of people's lives, and then this woman would come out of her door but never with this handsome man again, and it didn't seem quite the same. And then eventually she didn't live there anymore, so that was like a little snippet really of two young people in their late 20s in living in a house that looked really interesting, and they seemed to have a very interesting persona. And I'm just thinking, who else in my street? There was Zoe Redman, who lived not quite opposite, but I think opposite 32. And she was a filmmaker, and she lived with Steve Lippman, another filmmaker. And Zoe had this really nice, gregarious kind of character, and she just frequently laughed, and everyone really liked her. And she had two children, and again, she was a quite prolific worker. And I don't know how she managed, really. And Steve was like very confident and a real sort of go-getter. And I just thought, God, I wish I could be like that. And anyway, they lived opposite. And then further along down Caulfield Road, I don't know what number, but there was John Smith's house. And I never really knew John Smith, but there were these people that you just, the name would be heard, and people from probably the North Coast, and you'd hear about this John Smith who was making these films. And he lived sort of about halfway down, and I'd go past his house and I just thought it was particularly spooky. It had a really high hedge and it just seemed so dark. And while I lived at Caulfield Road, one of his films was on television, and he made a film of, I think it was an old derelict hospital at the back. I think it was down the end of Langford Road or something like that, and it was a slow kind of formalist film tracing the outside of that building. And then further on down the road on the corner was Dave and Sharon's house. And Sharon used to run the fine art course at Humberside. And Dave, I think, was a musician and a writer. And their house, I remember it being quite vulnerable because it was the end of the terrace and it was covered with ivy. And I think they had problems with their roof as well. But I'd never been inside it, but it seemed like one of the most rambling houses in the street and quite distinctive. And then going back up the street, because most of the houses were actually the ones that were close on the side of the railway line, and not many artists lived on the opposite side of the street, although Zoe Redmond did, and I think it was kind of the houses after 89 that were also earmarked. But I think Zoe's house actually never got knocked down, and she was offered it to buy the house, as some artists were. And I think she bought it and sold it, I'm not sure. And I have an inkling that she moved to France. And then further up the road, there was some sculptors, I think, called a guy called Mark and a woman called Ross. And they'd like sort of knocked through a wall in the upstairs, I think it was, and had their studios looking like quite an industrial kind of warehouse space, and had a really good storage system. That's what I remember about their house. And further up on the corner was the guy called Tony Daly, who I remember Eddie Chambers had included in one of his curations. And Tony was this tall, really elegant looking guy. And I remember one day seeing him walk up the street with a box of art materials and canvases balancing on his head. And he told me his mum taught him how to carry things like that, which is extremely useful, because I did ask him to try and teach me how to do it, but I could never get it right. But then eventually I just put a cushion on my head, because it's useful at the moment to get things up into my loft storage space. But anyway, just this tall, elegant figure walking down the road with these boxes on his head and canvases. And I also remember seeing Tony again, although I'd see him quite a few times walking down the road and chat to him. But another very particular funny time was late at night, coming through the ticket barriers, and Tony was standing there as if he was a ticket collector. You know, because he's a black guy, he was like playing on people's stereotypical perception and, you know, the whole history of Caribbean men coming to work on the London Underground and being very ironic, just standing there, and people were giving him money. So that was like one of Tony's innovative kind of political money-making ideas, which like had us in hysterics, and he was just so good at it. It was like a little performance piece, but I don't know if he'd remember that now. But Tony was with quite a lot of galleries and showing a lot at that time, but he never seemed to be able to pay his rent. He was always like really behind with his rent. And I remember when I left, and I went back, just, it was quite simple. I just went back to the Acme offices and handed in my keys. And then I'd heard about, I knew, because they wrote to me about this, we would get £100 compensation, which did surprise me, because I thought it was per house, and that me and Tara would probably get 500 each, but it was that we actually got £1,000 each. And I'd moved by this time and the money hadn't arrived, so I rung up and spoke to Sarah Greengrass and said, oh, I haven't received the £1,000. And she went, oh, are you actually up to date with your rent? And I said, yeah. And she said, oh, well, you're one of the few, because good job that there was that kind of compensation, because I think a lot of the artists had got behind in their rent, and that money was paying for the rent that they couldn't afford to pay. So I got this £1,000, and at the same time I'd sold a large photograph from a show that I had at the Camden Arts Centre to the South Bank for about £3,000, which was quite cheap because it was 10 feet across by 8 on canvas and stretchers, and a big black and white photograph, which is now in the collection. But because there was then a property slump, it enabled me to put that money down, 4,000 as a down payment for that. So it really helped me get a kick start, really. I mean, most definitely the whole place influenced my work, because at the time I was starting to look into my family history through my family album, but also through local history libraries. Like, I did, the first place I went to was the Museum of Labour History, which was then down in Limehouse, and I looked through the photographs there and found some interesting photographs of match women at home, and they had this rose wallpaper in the background, which was a reoccurring theme in my work. And I came across the strike register there and found that my great great aunt was listed in the 1888 register, Elizabeth Marchant, as living with her sister, which I quite like, this sort of single woman, independent woman, who was fighting for her rights. And from there, I was, at the time I was living at Colville Road, developing a whole series of installations called Wallpaper History. And then I had this interest in the surrounding empty spaces, these domestic spaces, which I think was reflected also in my own studio, this, the nature of my studio being this Victorian domestic space. And I was thinking about the placement of works in the kind of urban or East London environment, because there seemed to be not many opportunities in galleries, but I think there were, and there seemed to be not many galleries, but I think there were, because there was also, I worked quite a lot at camera work in Roman Road using their darkrooms, and this enabled me to be in, I think, about at least 3 shows there. And then there was the accessible nature of the Whitechapel, with the Whitechapel Opens and lecture and workshop programmes. And also the Tom Allen Centre in Stratford, which was an interesting, a reasonable size gallery, which was showing up and coming work, really. And I had this sort of idea about works in situ, and I found this like old little piece of writing I did on my typewriter, because I didn't have a word processor, and I'd type and they would be, the page would be quite indented, but I'd photocopy it to make it look slightly nicer. And it just says, works in situ can happen anywhere, mostly outside the gallery, in places such as derelict buildings, across wastelands, and in deserted overgrown gardens, across and inside bridges, generally into forgotten areas, enhanced by time and weathering. There are works in situ, acting as metaphors, reflecting the present declining situation in Britain, reflecting the condition of the immediate environment by collecting materials directly from those environments and creating through a means of reconstruction. Their works in situ because they are placed in situations other than galleries. They are works in situ because they belong to everyone and are intended to become part of the environment. And close to home was installed in 1987 and it stayed there till about 1989, and it faded to sepia tone, and then the image was becoming washed away into this kind of white sheet of paper, and that kind of made the house look untidy again. So at that point I removed it. And then I remember a little plaque, blue plaque, going up on in Colville Road in this other house that had become empty a little bit further on. And it was like a heritage plaque, and it said this house was once the home. And I always thought that it had been put there by Sheila Thompson and the local residents association, and then later found out that the plaque had been put there by Paul Noble, an artist in Philiphook Road. And that's what was quite interesting about those sighting work outside, is that like authorship was secondary, and this kind of mystery about something appearing and being interesting and catching your attention. And that I remember sort of thinking, God, I wish I'd done that plaque, what a good idea. And I since heard that that plaque was moved from house to house and eventually ended up in Claremont Road and then in the archive at the Museum of London. So other things that were happening in that at that time, which had quite an effect on the residents and just people in general, really, was the first thing was the poll tax, and it was pretty high, and I don't know how it was worked out, whether it was higher if you was living on your own or something like that. But anyway, I don't know anyone who paid that. I know that most of the artists I spoke to didn't, and I'm pretty sure the local residents probably wouldn't have bothered because they were living in these blighted houses. So like, what was the point? And anyway, as time went on, I received a letter calling me to go to the court in Walthamstow. So I went down there, and outside there were a number of people from the SWP briefing everyone as to what to say, which I can't quite remember, but it was a single sentence answer saying that you acknowledge the poll tax but you basically disagree with it and therefore you were refusing to pay, because the idea was to stop, take away and beat the poll tax, which eventually happened. And anyway, I went into the court and there was a huge crowd of people in the dock. And there was a woman judge, and she seemed to survey everyone one by one. And then she decided to draw an invisible line. She asked each person of their business, and everyone did this one sentence reply. And I said the reply, and then she drew a line by the side of me. And I just felt so relieved because she said that everyone else over this side had to come back this afternoon, and everyone over the other side had to wait for another letter. And fortunately, I was within that group. And I think it was quite discriminatory, actually, because it was like, as soon as I spoke and she heard my soft voice, she looked up and looked at me with this look, "What are you doing here?" And next to me was this guy from India, and she just like drew the line between me and him, and he was so frightened. And I came out of the court with him, and he said, "What should I do?" And the SWP said, "You've got to come back this afternoon." And I just said to him, "Have you got children?" And he said, "Yeah." And I just said, "You know, I would just go home and just never come back." And, you know, to this day, I don't know if I gave that man the worst advice in the world, but he just like legged it. And I just went home. And then I did get a letter, you know, several months later, calling me into court again. And I just thought, no, I'm just not going to go. And so I didn't. And then I started to get the bailiff's letters, which I think other artists were getting as well. But that was another reason why I decided to give up my Colville Road place. And I mean, eventually that sort of stuff, it all petered off with everything, but nothing happened. And then the whole poll tax system was, you know, debunked, and it, you know, was a really bad thing to happen for a lot of people, and just caused a lot of unnecessary stress. And so luckily that was done away with. But, you know, there were lots of things like that happening, I remember. And I did do a piece of work around that time in 1990, because that was kind of linked with the poll tax, because Transmissions Gallery used to be run by Malcolm Dixon, and a guy who was involved, Simon, with Projects UK, had joined forces to do a site-specific event called Sites Positions. And because of all the research I'd done into the Wallpaper History series on the Match Women strike and how that brought about new unionism for what it was worth, they said to me, "Look, in the archive there's some really interesting research to do with the rent strikes during the war, where people refused to pay their rent and the bailiffs would come and so forth, and people took direct action." And anyway, eventually it was done away with. The landlords were putting the rents up while the men were away fighting. And so they mentioned the Mitchell Library and that they would commission me to do some work. So I asked them if they could find me a tenement flat to do the work in. And I went to the Mitchell Library, and there was mostly photographs and news cuttings. But then I'd heard about this researcher called Sean Dammer, and that he'd done some interviews with people, and they were deposited in the working class movement library in Salford. So I went up there and got the pamphlet of his transcripts and went to visit him in Glasgow, and he liked the idea of the project so much that this, all his research would go back into the place where that history happened, in Govan, by the docks there. And so he just gave me his tapes to copy and use as I wished. And I gave the masters back afterwards, and he did come see the work, and it was crowded with local people because I got two people from the street to visualize the piece and managed to get them some temporary work on the project, paid work, because there was such a lot of high unemployment. So I do remember, actually, at Hackney Town Hall, this amazing news-cutting image of the people crowding round the town hall, standing on the windowsills and protesting. And similarly, the people were to crowd round the door to stop bailiffs coming in. And I had a really interesting image from the archive of the rent strike, with a house and people standing on the windowsills and everywhere surrounding the house, local people, to stop the bailiff from coming in. And this crowd scene I blew up and put on the boarded windows of the tenement house. And along the street, in the windows, were little notices saying, "No poll tax here," which was the contemporary situation. And then you got to my window, which had the huge image of the crowd superimposed on the window, and a little notice which said, "No rent strike here." So you got this echoing of the history, really. And I kind of think that when the artists moved in to the houses between Leighton and Leightonstone, that you did like feel, you know, I think because there were so many artists there, and the artists do talk about the local people and the artists, and it sounds really funny now, I think. And it was very kind of, I think, to do with the kind of huge number of artists. And then, because I think some people, I know my next door neighbours who, where a lot of guys from the north of England would be quite scathing about the artists. And then they actually started to mingle with the artists. And then I do remember a point when there was a lot more mingling going on, and the local people come into the open studios and talking to us in the pub, and then sort of some local people actually engaged in artists making work, because I know, because I had a problem that, you know, they would help you out actually, and I had a problem because I was making a piece called Shadows for the Subversive Stitch, an installation, and I wanted to interview my mum about her experience in the East End sweatshops, and she didn't want to be interviewed, but she said I could note down what she said, which I did do, as best I could. And in Manchester Corner House, I had a sewing machine which belonged to my great aunt, and it was fixed up to a timer. So when people walked in, the sewing machine would go on like this ghost machine, and projections around the walls were like this shadowy kind of cage of warped and weft pieces of fabric in the slide carriers, and kind of lace would be surrounding the area. And then I wanted this audio tape, a quarter inch tape, to be like a web over people's heads as they walked into the space. And that would have been ideally my mother and also me in conversation. But I was unable to do that. So I approached Sheila Thompson, because she was very, you know, she was very kind of sociable. And I asked her if she would do it. And I did say there was a little bit of a fee available as well. And she sort of said, okay. And so she came over to my flat and she just read the monologue of my mum's story. And I think she took part in John Smith's, I think she did the monologue for John Smith's film, I'm not quite sure. But I picked Sheila particularly because of her voice, because it was quite similar to my mum's, and it, the whole way that a voice locates, an accent locates somebody to a particular place. And I suppose a site specific notion of voice. Although everything is quite transitory and the texture of the voice seemed really fitting. And I suppose that kind of gave him an insight into some of the things that we were doing. And I know for me, the whole issue of class and my class background started to become really important around that time. And I did see an ad in Artist Newsletter for women from working class backgrounds who were practitioners who would maybe produce an issue of or submit to an issue of Feminist Arts News on class. And I saw it and I thought, oh yeah, that's me. But I didn't really have the bottle to apply, because it just seemed so personal in some ways. And because all the time I was doing work to do with my family history or histories that were connected to my family history, but then to do something so personal about your own experience seemed a little bit revealing. But then about 4 weeks after I saw this ad, I got a letter from Feminist Arts News asking me if I would be one of the guest editors for that issue, which I did do, and it was really interesting to do. And that was in 1990. And then 2 years later, they did another issue on class. And again, I was invited to be the guest editor on that, and I worked with Shaila Kumari Berman and another woman called Gabrielle, Irish woman who did some really interesting work herself, had just graduated, I think, from St Martin's. Gabrielle Humphreys, I think her name was. And so I was doing that sort of work as well, and did become interested in writing. And